Hello, this is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock calling.
It's 6 o'clock in New York City.
The use of steroids in Major League Baseball was widespread.
The major networks and newspapers are burying us in fluff and circumstance.
But between the ages of 12 and 30, Jesus' life is completely undocumented.
When you find out modern environmentalism is neo-feudalism.
Coal. It's the resource that generates half of our electricity at a third the cost of most other fuels. It's the fuel that powers our way of life.
Meanwhile, back in reality, humans are running out of food, an empire is collapsing, and the Bali Conference to save the climate tanked. All that, plus hunger striker Donna Dillman and our mystery guest calling from Taiwan, coming up on Radio EcoShock.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. It's like, why don't we adapt our force our children to adapt to the changing climate?
We are not prepared to accept, though, this formulation at this time.
Thank you.
The frustration began to show.
If for some reason you're not willing to lead, leave it to the rest of us. Please get out of the way.
That was at the Bali Conference in December, the place where humans failed to save their atmosphere. This is Radio EcoShock. We're going to do a tour of world media, getting reactions and feeling the pulse of propaganda. Hundreds of top scientists delivered their blunt warning, act now or lose the climate, where civilization arose. The head of the United Nations was pleading for concrete goals, starting soon. The European Union aligned with all of the developing nations, calling for mandatory cuts, 25 to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020. There sat the representatives of all the governments in agreement, except the dirty fuse. Canada acted as the goon for George Bush in many opinions, with Japan and Russia hiding quietly behind. The rest of the world was ready to act. In this atmosphere of high theater, on a heavenly tropical island of Bali, America appeared to bend, but did not. All the rest rushed in to grasp the appearance, the hope of further talks, the targets, the action to save the atmosphere, was dropped. We all lost. Scientists like James Lovelock and James Hansen, among thousands of others, have been clear. To our surprise, the climate is a delicate system. Even 1 degree of overall change can begin a chain of feedback loops that lead to a much hotter world. We have only a few years to drastically cut our emissions if we hope to limit this global warming to a level where our civilization can function. Now those years are being wasted in more rounds of talks. Perhaps we'll agree in 2012, the thinking goes, to institute changes that will start in 2030, just like the recent phony breakthrough in U.S. car mileage. Maybe our kids and grandchildren will do something about it. It's heartbreaking. Governments cannot adapt to new realities, and most humans still dream of fossil riches of giant cars and air conditioning. Let's see what we can find on the airwaves in these dark days before the storm. First up, United Nations Secretary Ban Ki-moon pleads for action at Bali.
We work for success. We don't work for failure. We must succeed from this Bali meeting. We must be able to launch negotiation with the time-bound negotiation for international agreement, hope by the end of 2009, with a clear agendas for present and future. We must be able to adopt this Bali roadmap. We have capacity in technology, finance, and science has made it quite clear. Only lacking is political will. I again urge the leaders to exercise their political will.
Next, we hear the UN's main climate man, a tired-looking Ivo de Boer, right after the conference ended.
In terms of the future, Bali has delivered what it needed to deliver, a very ambitious agenda going forward. I see it as transparent because a process that in the past was always a closed intergovernmental process is now opening up to the participation of business, civil society, international financial institutions, and the UN system to bring their expertise to this process over the coming year.
As the focus fell to the biggest polluter with the most resources to change to renewable energy, we find that the Bush administration gave up exactly nothing. Here is a spokesman for the American Enterprise Institute, a close ally and advisor to the Bush administration. He is Kenneth Green.
The U.S. actually carried the day in terms of getting its what its hard lines were. They did not want hard targets. They didn't get them. They did not want a commitment to a follow-on or to tighten up Kyoto, and they avoided that.
Even then, the White House backpedaled the very next day, as we hear from the BBC.
It took 13 days and a last-minute change of mind by the Americans to bring what the delegates thought was a successful resolution to the Bali Climate Conference. There was general agreement on a so-called roadmap to reduce carbon emissions. To the disappointment of the Europeans, there was no commitment on definite targets. Gordon Brown and Germany's Angela Merkel were among those happy that Bali was at least pointing the way forward. But no sooner were the delegates on the way home than the White House issued a statement saying it had serious concerns about what had been agreed. The principle signed up to in Bali was that developed countries should lead the way. But the White House statement said major developing countries should likewise act. That's believed to be a reference to countries like India and China. But the U.S. accepted that smaller and poorer countries couldn't be expected to cut emissions so rapidly. Green groups have accused Washington of diluting the deal. The aid charity Oxfam called it a deep insult to the world's poorest people. Andy Moore, BBC News.
While we're listening to British reaction, let's go to the BBC, December 16th, 2007. George Monbiot offers his opinion.
But there was no agreement in Bali on the level of mandatory CO2 cuts. Without that agreement, the world will continue to warm.
Without these binding mandatory targets, we can make all these vague expressions of goodwill and say what vaguely needs to be done, but nothing will actually happen. We have to say this is a level to which greenhouse gases must come down by a certain date.
The lack of coverage of the Bali Climate Conference in mainstream American media was stunning. You had to search through the usual political bump and the odd stories category to find any mention of the climate discussions. There was nothing on the main video page of ABC News, for example. CBS had a tiny feature on poor countries demanding green tech. My bet is most Americans remained unaware of this important venture or the results. Here's a bit from ABC News.
But with the Arctic ice receding by a dizzying pace, can the agreement, like so many before it, actually do anything to put the brakes on global warming? Here's ABC's Liz Morlanthis.
We consider this to be an historical day.
Well, maybe. Delegates from 190 countries agreed to a roadmap for climate change. That's right, a roadmap, essentially agreeing that change could happen, but not until 2009.
It gives the world an opportunity, but not a guarantee, that we'll reach an agreement within 2 years that is up to the task of preventing dangerous global warming.
Think baby steps. Even getting this far has been a challenge.
We are not prepared to accept, though, this formulation at this time.
Thank you. Thank you, United States.
The Bush administration originally opposed the deal.
Leave it to the rest of us. Please get out of the way.
But eventually, in a rare shift, the U.S. backed down. It's the latest example of the pressure the White House is facing at home and abroad when it comes to global climate change.
The Arctic is experiencing faster melting.
Public awareness of the issue is up, way up, thanks to former Vice President / Nobel Peace Prize winner Al Gore. Still, it may all amount to very little.
In a statement, the White House said that while aspects of the Bali Agreement are positive, it still has, quote, serious concerns, and that for climate change to be adequately addressed, major developing countries, translation China and India, must commit to emissions cuts as well.
The hard part now, hammering out specifics. Of course, by then, the chief negotiator will no longer be George W. Bush, but his successor. For Good Morning America, Liz Marlantis, ABC News, Washington.
Australia, which has suffered terribly from climate-induced drought, had this to say.
Finally, the UN Climate Conference in Bali has its roadmap for an extension of the Kyoto Protocol. It's basically an agreement for more talks in 2009 to extend the treaty beyond 2012. But the breakthrough didn't come easily. Resentment swelled and tempers flared among the 190 international delegates before the United States made a key concession. Eventually, it was a much watered-down agreement.
The European Union told the floor it backs a compromise deal to help these talks move forward.
Thank you, Mr. President. Portugal, on behalf of the European Union, wishes to tell you that we support the text you present to this plenary.
All week, the sticking point has been the United States' refusal to include targets of up to 40% emission cuts by 2020. But it's believed that text has been watered down. Talks then stalled and tempers flared as China took the floor.
And I would like to ask apologies from the Secretariat for repeating this. Thank you, Mr. President.
China is still negotiating its role in the final text, and until that's finalised, they called for the meeting to be suspended and a vote to be put on hold.
This meeting lays the groundwork for negotiations on a new climate deal when the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012. Green groups want Australia to step up its role and commit to short-term global emissions targets and try and broker a stronger international agreement.
Well, we've ratified, but this meeting is not entirely gratifying. Australia's going to need to move into a leadership role in these international negotiations if in 2 years' time we can put our hands on our hearts and say we've done our best to stop dangerous climate change.
After a fortnight of intense and frustrating debate, the UN climate negotiator walked out in high emotion. Sarah Clark, ABC News, Bali.
Let's hear from the Greens, the Friends of Earth, speaking to the BBC.
I think that we would have a much different perspective to Hillary Benn. What we've seen happening this morning is that the countries have been forced to compromise to get the US to agree to a deal, basically.
Here's an excerpt from Stefan Schuritz of the European Greens and EFA after the conference.
Well, in fact, I see it on two layers. The first layer is if you really judge the result, the outcome, the basic outcome. There one has to state absolutely clear that it's far from what is necessary. If you see the scientific facts that are even worse than the IPCC predicts, and already the IPCC acknowledgements are really critical. So if you regard on the, or if you regard the scientific facts, one has to make absolutely clear that the outcome is far from what has been necessary. The second layer is, what is the underlying issue here? And it became apparent that it's, that there's no trust at all from the developing countries towards the, developed countries. And I think, this also became clear in the showdown now. The developing country deeply mistrusts the developed country, and in particular the U.S., and I think this is by purpose.
In Canada, scientist and broadcaster David Suzuki spoke to the national public broadcaster, CBC.
That Canada, probably among all countries in the world, is as susceptible to climate change as any other country. We're a northern country. We know that the heating is going to go on much more, much greater towards the poles, and Inuit have been telling us that for years. We have the longest marine coastline of any country in the world. Just the expansion from warming of the ocean is going to flood our coastlines. And we still depend on agriculture, forestry, fisheries, tourism that are all climate sensitive. Canada is very vulnerable to the impact of climate change. So why isn't Canada up there beating the bushes and saying we need concrete targets and timelines? And what we get, at least the indications I've gotten from our performance at APEC in Sydney and the recent meetings of the Commonwealth in Africa, are that we're not serious about it at all. First of all, the rhetoric is, well, we've got to act on climate. Thank goodness our government is at least saying that, but we can't do anything that will jeopardize the economy. Wait a minute now. Our world is the air, water, and land where life exists. That can't grow anymore. It's fixed. Surely that ought to be setting our agenda, not the economy. The economy doesn't come above that. And what is the government now proposing? Aspirational targets. What the hell is an aspirational target? The previous government said we'll have voluntary compliance. Seems to me it's the same thing. What it is, it says, oh, please, please, industry, please be good guys. Do your best, please. It doesn't work.
Canada, led by its Environment Minister John Baird, played the villain, threatening to kill off the possibility of a deal unless carbon emissions in China, India, and the poorer countries were cut in the same way. Let the poorest people live without electricity, says Canada, while we burn up the roads and leave our mansions well lit. Canada won an award as Fossil of the Day. The rest of the world hardly knows that Baird and the Conservatives are the party least liked by the majority of Canadians. Their minority opinion, their support of the Bush oil regime, does not represent anything like the public opinion polls back home. Here is Steve Gibault on CBC Radio.
Unfortunately, because of the consistent obstruction by Canada, the U.S. and Japan, where we could have had an historical agreement here in Bali, we have to go back home with a watered-down agreement.
In North America, the group at avaaz.org, that's A-V-A-A-Z.org, organized a last-minute internet campaign to put pressure on governments. Of the 600,000 signatories, over 300,000 came in during the last 72 hours of the talks. People do care. Meanwhile, as we famously know, Al Gore spoke for the rest of Americans who do care about climate change. In the wake of Katrina, wildfires, and strange wind and ice storms, Americans don't support Bush on climate either.
I am not an official of the United States, and I am not bound by the diplomatic niceties. So, I am going to speak an inconvenient truth. My own country, the United States, is principally responsible for obstructing progress here in Bali. We all know that. We all know that. But my country is not the only one that can take steps to ensure that we move forward from Bali with progress and with hope.
So did these gathered dignitaries achieve anything? All governments promised to meet again to form a new successor to the Kyoto Treaty. This new international instrument to be drawn up by 2009 and implemented, we don't know when, will call for deep cuts to climate emissions. Unless we see a fundamental change of heart in a new American administration, right at the 2009 deadline year, all this would be voluntary. The same fuzzy scheme which has allowed us to double and keep doubling the growth of our greenhouse gas emissions. The conference agreed that developing nations could be paid to preserve the last tropical forests in exchange for carbon credits. If you don't cut down your forests, we'll feel better about using coal to power Las Vegas and Disneyland. That was one of the deals. A group of major international corporations may be setting up a carbon market to make enormous profits out of the climate crisis. That is supposed to save the atmosphere in some distant future using the allegedly free market. As Stephen Leahy of IPS News Service reports, there were a couple of bright spots. The Dutch finally agreed to, quote, stop subsidizing oil palm for use as biodiesel and Germany announced it would cut its emissions by 40% by 2020. Good for Germany if they can do it. The Western countries have agreed to talk about transferring cleaner energy to the developing world. Every week or so, a new coal-fired power plant opens in China. That generating plant will burn three times the coal required by an American plant for the same amount of electricity. Why? Because although better burning technology is well known, the intellectual property is being held back. The world burns because we will not share our know-how. Many nations at the conference called for a transfer of green technology. There was agreement, but nothing firm came out of it yet. Humans just don't get it. Mansions and wealth will not survive a final fight out and forced migration toward the poles. Meanwhile, the rest of us plan flights to holiday destinations, drive around for the fun of it, and piss away the whole supply of fossil fuels. Why leave anything for the kids? We'll all be dead then anyway, right? According to the World Meteorological Organization, the decade of 1998 to 2007 was the warmest on record. In Britain, the Hadley Centre and the University of East Anglia reported that the top 11 warmest years occurred in the last 13 years. Millions of people are already suffering from climate change. A flurry of press releases from groups like the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization warn that global warming will hit the poorest developing nations the hardest. Africa is already suffering. Is it possible that the world will be divided into the haves and the dying? Is this the coming cull, the mass murder by climate change, the climacost? Will we allow this? That would be the result, say many of our best scientists, if the world follows the sleepy path of American business and its last renegade allies. That is what happens if we all go on slurping carbon and dumping our exhaust into the fragile skies. 2009 seems to loom like a final deadline. Can we motivate enough millions of people, change enough politics and lives to save the world as we know it? 2 years to doomsday decisions. Please, out of compassion for the future, turn off the television and spend that time in action. Go ahead. Become a climate fanatic. The future needs you now. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Okay, we're going to break things up just a little bit. We're going to try an experiment. We have a listener calling in from Taipei, Taiwan, from a telephone booth outside a 7-Eleven. Scientists, like James Lovelock, warn that most life must move towards the poles if we force a new climate with our greenhouse gases. What would that be like? We have a caller from the People's Republic of China, Taiwan. Dan Bloom has begun to imagine what life would be like in polar cities, the sustainable retreats that humans might seek. Dan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex, for inviting me on the show.
What is a sustainable polar retreat, and how did you begin to think about this?
Well, you know, I have to say right off the bat, I got the idea from reading the books and interviews with James Lovelock of England. And in his latest interviews this past fall, he spoke about the possibility that in the future, maybe only in 100 years from now, there might be just breeding pairs of human beings living in the Arctic to ensure the survival of the species. And this phrase stuck in my mind, you know, breeding pairs of people. And I thought, oh my God, if it really came to that, that's when I had this a kind of eureka moment. And I said, well, they can't just live out in the open. Where will these breeding pairs live? And I began to envision polar cities or polar villages or polar communities that I now call sustainable polar retreats that might be built 100 years from now, that might be used maybe 500 years from now. Certainly not now, but I got the idea from James Lovelock, and I think it's good for people to start thinking about these polar cities and talking about them.
Well, it's so hard to imagine a warm polar region, but the Arctic Sea does appear to be opening up, at least in the summer. But how will we cope with the lack of sunlight for 6 months?
Well, you know, in the future, the polar regions probably won't be very cold. They'll probably be temperate regions. And there will be 6 months of darkness and 6 months of sunlight. I lived in Alaska for 10 years, so I know a little bit about this feeling. I want to say one thing, Alex, at the outset. This whole concept of polar cities is very far out and very off the radar. What I really want to do is set up what I call a non-threatening thought experiment for people just to think about these things. I can't see the future, and I'm not a predictor, and I'm not even a scientist. But I think if worse comes to worse, if the predictions of some of the scientists that we're reading today say that the Earth really is heating up, maybe in 200 years or 300 years, maybe 30 generations down the road, human beings might have to live in polar cities. So my concept is let's begin designing, talking about, and even locating where they might be now. But the main thrust of this is a kind of like internet theater or global warming theater. It's just to stretch the imagination, and my main goal is to wake people up who need waking up and to scare people who need scaring into taking action about global warming now. My main goal is to get more people to take global warming seriously now and do something in their personal lives to try to stop global warming now. I'm not really concerned about 500 years from now. Exactly. It's a kind of a theater. It's a kind of a game to make people focus, even more importantly, on today.
And you have created some models. Can you give us the address for your blog and so people
yes.
can see what you're doing?
You know, I would love it if some of the listeners went to the blog. An artist in Taiwan made a conception of some architectural blueprints. It's at http://pcillu101.blogspot.com. Also, Alex, if people Google the term polar city or polar cities, plural, they'll find many, many, many links about this subject. And what I'm most interested in is I want to get feedback from people. What do people think, pro or con?
And there's another one at climatechange3000.blogspot.com that links right to your site, too.
Yes, I have another. My original blog with just text is climatechange3000.blogspot.com. And there I have some questions and some scenarios of what polar cities might be like. You know, Alex, this is a very far-out idea, and I hope it never comes to this. But maybe it will, and it's kind of interesting to play with the idea now. Who will live there? Who will govern these polar cities? Who will protect them? Who will be let in? Who will be kept out? It could be a very, very ugly science fiction story. I hope not. That's why I want to put this forward now on the internet and on radio and in news media around the world just to get people thinking. I think I'll tell you something very interesting, Alex. Nobody else in the world has come up with this concept. I don't know why. If you Google Polar City, nobody else has been doing this at all.
That's true. We do have the one sort of model we can work with, the Doomsday Vault, where they're putting the seeds up on the island.
Yes, and in fact, you know, I'll tell you what, I'm a collector of a lot of information. This also influenced me. The Doomsday Vault in Norway, when I saw the images in the newspaper here in Taiwan of the Doomsday Vault, I said, wow, well, it's very interesting to put the seeds there. It could also be a very good image of what life might be like if people have to live there. Well, in fact, I've written to the crop organization that's sponsoring the Doomsday Vault, and they know about my Polar Cities idea.
And you can go on YouTube and search for Svalbard, S-V-A-L-B-A-R-D, and find some great images there of what it's like to live in the Arctic in the nighttime. And
there's some wonderful images about Svalbard Norway about what the seasons are like. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of people who are tuned into this, and I think the polar cities concept can just help people focus, and we can get more and more discussions going. In fact, the New York Times interviewed me last week and is going to report on polar cities very, very soon.
Well, it's terrible that it's come to this, but after the Bali conference, we had a chance, and we had all the scientific warnings, and we really haven't done a darn thing about reining in greenhouse gases. Where do you see this going for you? What's your next
step? Well, you know, I'm just doing this out of compassion for the future. I don't have any children. I'm not worried about my grandchildren or my great-grandchildren, but I really care about the world. I love life. I'm an optimist. I'm a positive person. What I want to do is to devote the rest of my life to collecting more and more information, more and more feedback about what polar cities might be like, to help plan for the possibility of this. And again, I hope it never comes to that. But I, you know, from reading all the global warming and climate change literature that I see, I think actually there's a 99% chance we're going to need polar cities. But not now, and not even in 2100. My guesstimate is 2500.
Well,
so we have 30 more generations to plan. But it's going to take a long time for people to accept this. You understand it because you're also a student of global warming. Most people I email to, I get a lot of angry, nasty emails.
Really?
People are in denial. You'll see when you read my blog again, I get a lot of angry emails. Not from deniers, even from people who accept global warming, but they think I'm going too far off the deep end here. And I'm not. I know exactly what I'm doing. I'm just trying to give people a platform, a focus to think about one possible scenario. We might as well get ready. But again, you know, I really want to say the focus of my work is to get people to take action now. We need to change our lifestyles. My own feeling is we need to stop all airplane traffic. We need to stop all car traffic now. Go back to bicycles. Go back to the old primitive lifestyle of 300 years ago. We need to stop. But if I say that, no one will listen. So polar cities is a way for me to talk about radically changing our lifestyles without saying that word.
Well, thanks so much for calling, Dan. You've really got us thinking about this one. We're talking
Thank
about
you. You know, Alex, I want to tell you, you're the first radio reporter in the world to take an interest in this, and I thank you very deeply.
Well, it's because I've listened to Sir James Lovelock, too, and James Hansen, who says we may be heading towards a different planet. I take these scientists very seriously, so thank you for having some vision that might stir us out of this rut that we're in and do something about it.
Thank you. Well, you know, I'm just a field worker. The real heroes are James Hansen and James Lovelock and many, many other scientists doing the real hard statistical work. But you're right. We need to listen to them.
From a phone booth in Taiwan, we've been speaking with Dan Bloom about cities in the far north. Thanks again, Dan.
You're welcome. Sayonara.
Avast, mateys. There be pirates about. Last fall, Radio EcoShock did a two-part investigative special on Planktos, the company who proposed to grab carbon dioxide out of the air by fertilizing ocean plankton with iron filings. We heard from the very persuasive CEO of the company, Russell George, and then from three of his critics, including Greenpeace, the ETC Group, and Vancouver stock columnist David Baines.
And their financial filings look a little rocky. A lot of publicity, but so far, no revenues. Do you think they can hang on?
No, I don't.
Mr. Baines was very suspicious of the stock trading behind Planktos, which hoped to make millions of dollars creating carbon credits. The major owner of Planktos is Nelson Scalbania, who has been involved in several boom-and-bust companies and a fraud conviction. David Baines' instincts may have been quite correct. First of all, the ship purchased by Planktos, the Weatherbird 2, did not sail toward the South Pacific, as announced by the company. The research vessel was found in Bermuda by the Sea Shepherd Society and was last seen steaming east into the Atlantic. A Planktos company released December 19th says the ship was denied entry into the port of Las Palmas in the Canary Islands, just off the coast of Africa. So they had to put into the Portuguese-controlled island of Madeira. Environmentalists feared the company would engage in ocean dumping to rack up unsubstantiated carbon credits with unknown consequences to the marine ecosystem. The international regulating body, the London Dumping Convention, specifically warned against such geoengineering experiments by private companies. Now it looks like the jig may be up for Planktos. The company says the boat will stay in Madeira. The company admits, quote, a current inability to secure sufficient funding for the continued operation of its business plan. This has, quote, forced management to consider a general winding down of its business operations. Apparently, despite $2 million in new funding the company claimed earlier this fall, Planktos is out of money. The firm may have serious trouble raising any more. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, has banned any trading of Planktos Corp. on the NASDAQ over-the-counter bulletin board. The 12-month ban came after Planktos was repeatedly late posting corporate filings. Now, a well-informed stock trading blog called Climateer Investing has a December 20th headline, Did Planktos Commit a Fraud Upon the Market? The questions come because the $2 million injection was announced at nearly double the actual selling price of the stock and seems never to have been explained in a clear way. Climateer Investing points out that stock hustlers generally know it is better to file required reports late or never at all than to file an untruth, which can lead to criminal charges. The blog continues, quote, All in all, an odd situation, especially considering that the third quarter filing was delayed until the company's only tangible asset was moved out of U.S. jurisdiction, end quote. That would be the ship, the Weatherbird 2. Planktos CEO Russell George got worldwide coverage when he announced he would plant a special forest in Hungary to offset the carbon emissions of the Vatican. Now they say, quote, the company is presently in need of funds to support its ocean and forest-based projects, end quote. Maybe the Pope needs to learn that a fast-moving California businessman may not be able to offer indulgences for carbon sins. The only real solution for the papacy is a whole lot of alternative energy and a whole lot less flying. Planktos shares have tumbled from a 52-week high of $2.56 to a measly 9 cents a share. I see the white flag coming up as this ocean geoengineering dream crumbles into another stock market hole for investors. Russell George worked with the tree planting company in British Columbia and briefly worked for Greenpeace in Vancouver in the 1980s. He then developed a double persona where he was an alleged expert in both nuclear fusion, with another promotional company that never delivered there, and ocean science. He was trained in neither field, but relies on a quick mind and persuasive speaking ability. You can hear our exclusive one-hour interview with Russ George and the follow-up one-hour investigative show at our website, ecoshock.org. Just look in the Oceans section of our audio on-demand menu. For Stockhounds, Google Planktos and Business Wire for December 19th and climateerinvest.blogspot.com. That's climateerinvest.blogspot.com for December 20th. The company website is www.planktos.com. For an entertaining read, Google The Wizard of Half Moon Bay, a critical biography of Russell George composed by Steve Krivet of NewEnergyTimes.com. Steve Krivet notes this may not be the first time Russell George claimed to have $2 million that never showed up. According to Krivet, George told a March 2005 meeting he had sold his fusion energy company for $2 million, but that later showed up as a debenture, a promise of money in another company, rather than an actual cash sale. We may see the same kind of magic for the $2 million infusion of cash in Planktos if the company filings ever show up. Meanwhile, I feel a little sorry for the bright-faced young college grads the Planktos company hired, including an alleged former Greenpeace captain. Presumably, they are all flying back from Madeira without a ship or a job. Was it all a dream or a con job? This story is still developing, but the winner is the Pacific Ocean off the Galapagos Islands. Russ George doesn't get to dump thousands of tons of iron into the sea for a stock market profit. Let's catch up with another EcoShock story we've been following.
I'm speaking with Donna Dillman, who's done a long hunger strike to protest uranium mining in Ontario. And Donna, how are you doing?
Well, all things considered, I'm actually doing quite well.
And how long was your hunger strike?
I went for 66 days on juices, and then the last two were water only, so 68 total.
And what was the purpose of doing that?
Well, I was looking for a moratorium on uranium exploration and mining in eastern Ontario because just a half an hour from my door and upriver of a million people in Ottawa, the drilling was about to take place, and still is about to take place.
And you got as far as the legislature, I understand, and stood out on the steps?
I did. After 47 days here, living on the site, just outside the gate in a tent trailer, I decided that increased awareness would probably result from a move to Queen's Park. So, yes, I moved down there for the final 2.5 weeks.
Well, you know, part of my interest in this story, of course, is I really dislike uranium. I think it's a very dangerous product. It's best left in the ground. Every part of the cycle just ends up in reactors that are risky, and then nuclear waste or maybe even bombs or depleted uranium. It's a long and horrible list, so I'm with you 100% on that. But, you know, part of my interest in your cause and your challenge to the government here is that we see so few Canadians willing to put themselves on the line and do tough protests on other issues as well, like climate change. So would you recommend this method? Do you see this as a new tool for activism?
Well, the fact that this is uranium is a no-brainer, but generally, on the bigger picture, it's the direction that our government is leading us. And I liken it to the runaway train that's, you know, heading fast for the precipice, and here we are in our seats, and our government would have us with their policies and you know, what they're coming up with as far as climate change and carbon footprint and all of that. They'd have us get up out of our seats and turn around and walk toward the caboose while the train continues on its merry way. And I think that as a population, we're going to have to get up out of our seats and turn that train around, or at least get off of it. And so do I recommend this or something like this? Absolutely. As long as we're going, kind of quietly in the night with our blinders on, we're going to be led over that precipice, and our children aren't going to thank us.
How can a person who is thinking about doing a hunger strike, I mean, do you have to be young and totally fit, or do you do a little research to find out how to look after your body? What would you recommend?
At 53 and not totally fit, although not out of shape too badly either, I had done some fasting, so I knew what to expect from the hunger end of it, and I knew that my big issue was going to be the cold, and I started this on October 8th, so it was bone-chilling cold, and that zapped my energy more than anything in the beginning. So, yeah, lots of research, talk to people, but, you know, you can also kind of, I think we need to be taking to the streets. I think we need to be organizing. What I like that came out of this is that a really stellar group of organizations came together. I don't know if you've mentioned this to your listenership, but Greenpeace and the Sierra Club and David Suzuki Foundation, Voices of Women, Students for Climate Change, Mining Watch Canada, I've probably missed one or two, but they all came together in a matter of days to, because it appeared that, and this sounds drastic, but I think it's true, that it appears that McGuinty would have had, and company, would have had me die before giving a moratorium, and I wasn't about to quit. This group came together, and they're joining with the Community Coalition Against Mining Uranium and doing a citizens' inquiry, so that the information will be out there, and hopefully more and more people will come on board. And I do believe it's a numbers game. If we get enough numbers, we can even win against big industry. But that's what we're up against.
Well, it's great to see that really one person can get such a big ball rolling, and I think it's going to keep rolling, and hopefully that the uranium will never be developed in eastern Ontario or anywhere else in Canada, because for me, nuclear is just not the option.
Wouldn't it be nice if anywhere in the world? I know that just a couple of weeks ago, Ireland passed a resolution that it would stay on the ground there. So there's a country doing it, and we've had provinces, Nova Scotia and BC. Labrador is currently in doing hearings. So this is doable. It's all about a change in direction, though. We need to put people in community and environment ahead of money, or at least on par with it.
How can people follow your story on the Internet?
They can key into www.cc.ca. amu.ca, and that's Community Coalition Against Mining Uranium.
Well, Donna Dillman, thanks for taking the time to talk with us on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
World food supplies are dropping rapidly as food prices rise around the globe. We only have 12 weeks' worth of wheat stored up at current world consumption rates, and just 8 weeks' worth of corn. That's way down from the days when humans had at least 1 year's worth of cereal crops to protect them from bad harvests. Even in 2005, we had 18 weeks of wheat, not just 12. The United Nations-backed Food and Agriculture Organization reported December 17, 2007, that due to, quote, unforeseen and unprecedented changes, our supplies are dropping and food prices are climbing to record levels. The FAO's food price index went up by over 40% this year, compared with just 9% increase last year. U.S. wheat futures broke the $10 a bushel ceiling last week, a milestone similar to $100 a barrel oil. Wheat prices are up 52% over last year, a gain of $130 a ton. The FAO directly cited the early impacts of climate change as one cause of the shortage. Crops in North Africa were hit hard by drought. Lack of rain also whacked wheat production in Australia, the world's second largest wheat exporter, to poorer nations. This year's crop fell 30% below government forecasts. Some Australian farmers are giving up. Others moved to Tasmania, which has more reliable rain. Add the unusual weather events like typhoon flooding and storms, which heavily damaged crops in the fields. According to an article by Elizabeth Rosenthal in the International Herald Tribune for December 17th, quote, the recent scientific papers concluded that farmers could adjust to 1 degree Celsius, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, to 3 degrees Celsius, 5.4 degrees, of warming by switching to more resilient species, changing planting times, or storing water for irrigation, for example. But after that, all bets are off, said Francesco Turbiello of Columbia University Earth Institute. Many people assume that we will never have a problem with food production on a global scale, but there is a strong potential for negative surprises. End quote. If you want to follow up on this, Mark Howden of the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization in Canberra, Australia, has written a series of papers on climate change and the global food supply, and it's published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The weather is becoming the news, folks. What could be more dependent on a stable climate than agriculture? As global warming kicks in, we will have less food to feed millions more people every year. Well, that can't end well. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, is blaming soaring food prices as a spin-off on the demand for biofuels. An IMF report by the chief economist Simon Johnson finds that ethanol production with corn doesn't amount to much net energy, and it leads to pressure on food prices for the poor. Instead of growing food for local consumption, some developing countries are making biofuels for export. Drivers in the Western countries and China can motor about, literally taking the food from the mouths of the poorest people. That is one reason for the so-called tortilla riots in Mexico City this year. Yet another factor in countries like China with a rising income, people want to live Western consumer lifestyles, including a growing demand for dairy products and meat. When mainly vegetarian nations switch to meat and dairy, we're in big trouble, because it takes up to 10 times as much grain or corn to produce the same amount of basic food provided by the cereals themselves, not to mention much bigger emissions of greenhouse gases from raising cattle. Meanwhile, a raft of countries are trying to stall off public unrest by banning food exports, while dropping all duties on food imports. Where countries like Turkey used to have duties of up to 130% on food imports to protect their own farmers, they now have no duty. The impact on local agriculture is simply unknown, but we have to feed the city people or political and social instability results. The United Nations warns that most people in richer countries can still afford to buy food, but those who will go hungry or starve are in the poorest, developing countries. For example, the highest rates of malnutrition in the world are in Bangladesh. More than half of school-aged children are underweight and suffering from vitamin deficiencies. Women are also underfed there, leading to chronic fatigue. The UN warns that escalating food prices and shortages will lead to political instability. They might have added an increased risk of terrorism as well. Just in the past year, there have been food riots, protests, or stampedes in Mauritania, China, Senegal, India, Pakistan, Morocco, Mexico, Yemen, Indonesia, and Burkina Faso. I got that list from an ongoing discussion about food prices at theoildrum.com. That's a very useful resource to watch the impact of world energy supplies. Oildrum.com. Check it out. Are we prepared to accept mass starvation as just another news item on the TV screens? Of course, if you look around a little in the wrong parts of town, you'll find people going hungry right in your own city. The urban myth of old people eating dog food is coming back as food prices rise in Europe and North America as well. Here is the way one TV network, CBS, covers the story.
I'm Cynthia Bowers in Chicago, where many people may be spending less at the malls because they're spending so much for food. Groceries across the board are up 5% this year, double their normal increase, and it's beginning to hit home. This father of two, Chris Ramirez, says every time his groceries are rung up, he feels rung out.
What do you think when you see the cashier hit that total button?
Oh, shocked. Everything just keeps going up, and it seems like the paychecks are staying the same.
He'll still bring home the bacon, but it'll cost 22 cents more per pound than it did last year, up to $3.66. White bread is up 10 cents to $1.24. Cheddar cheese up 48 cents to $4.47 a pound. Eggs are up 51 cents a dozen. But it is the price of milk that is really getting hard to swallow, up 90 cents over this time last year. Why? Because the grains it takes to feed animals and make many foods, corn, soybeans, wheat, and rice, have all recently hit record highs. High demand and poor harvest are to blame for dangerously low supplies worldwide.
Food inflation is here to stay, and it's going to get worse.
Don't expect relief anytime soon. No one knows how high groceries will go, but it is a safe bet next year's prices will make today's look like a bargain. Cynthia Bowers, CBS News, Chicago.
There is nothing there on the American media about starving kids in faraway countries or the use of biofuels. Just a worried consumer at home. Bon appetit. Well, I had hoped to cover a bit of the world financial crisis, but it looks like we've chewed through all our time for this week. Why should environmentalists care about the finance world? Well, for one thing, when the economy tumbles, as we've heard already, people far away die of hunger. Maybe the worst diehard green thinks that's a good thing, but I don't see starvation in a world of plenty as any kind of solution. The other big hook to the financial story is just this. The coming depression may rob us of the investment money we need to refit the economy to use sustainable, non-polluting energy sources like the sun, the tide, the wind. It always goes this way. The pirates at the top of the pile steal as much as they can. When the House of Cards collapses, then a more populist government arrives to find an empty piggy bank. I spent a whole day just reading through the American edition of the Financial Times for December 17, 2007. In an article called "Out of the Shadows, How Banking's Hidden System Broke Down," you will learn the awful truth. The supposed pillars of financial respectability, the biggest banks in the world, have created a second, hidden banking system that has literally been printing money out of thin air. These off-book investment vehicles are not shown on the annual reports. They can take a relatively small amount of money and make derivative loans that multiply $10 million, say, to as much as $800 million, hoping no one ever comes to collect. It's like 10 men playing poker at a table. The bets are fabulous, millions of dollars on each hand. But if a crook comes in with a gun, you will find each man has only a few bucks in his pocket. The poker players have created a derivatives market, where they claim over $500 trillion in assets, many times the actual wealth of the world when you consider real estate and business and all of that. Somebody is cheating, and when the game is called, a whole lot of people are going to lose big. It could be your pension plan or even your bank going bust. As you know, a combination of a half dozen of the world's largest central banks just offered an additional $40 billion of money to those banks, hoping to get them lending again. Small business loans are disappearing, research money is dead, mortgage money is sketchy, and $40 billion is just about one drop in an ocean of at least a half quadrillion dollars of unsecured debt. The rumor on Wall Street is the whole system is being held together by glue and fancy dancing until the brokers get their Christmas bonus. Merry Christmas, gentlemen, and thanks for nothing. It looks like 2008 is going to be a turbulent year. Radio EcoShock will be there to call the punches and peer into the future solutions for all of us. We have upcoming specials on previous greenhouse worlds and abrupt climate change. And my New Year's resolution is to get more of you on the air with more personal solutions to surviving this mess and limiting the damage. Well, that's about as hopeful as I can get. During the holidays, I'll also be broadcasting some of the best climate speeches of 2007, plus some of the questions and answer periods that we never had time for from some of the big speeches recorded right here in Vancouver. George Monbiot, Ross Gelbspan, and many more coming up on Radio EcoShock. I know many of you are downloading free environment audio from our website at ecoshock.org. We get over 1,000 unique visitors, taking away more than 4 gigs of MP3 files every single day. The spoken green word is definitely getting out there. Grab a pile for yourself for the holidays to get a grip on the issues while there's still time at ecoshocklikeanelectricshock.org. Have a great holiday season, I really mean that. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We'll go out with John Mayer from his album Continuum, the song Waiting for the World to Change.